Good morning, everyone, and good afternoon, evening, anyone that's actually listening in. And I hope everything is going well. I hope you're all trying to get some sleep. It's not very easy when you're actually at the feast. And you try preparing sermons as well. But no, it is. I hope you all are trying to get some sleep and trying to get some exercise and trying to look after your health. Because we haven't seen too bad as far as health is concerned. Some feasts can be really horrendous. You know, half the congregation. In fact, you almost book a hall that is about half the size, so you have just reckon half the congregation is going to be away. But no, this time has been not too bad at all. It's been very good. But you know, today is an anniversary. It's an anniversary of something that took place 80 years ago, back in 1929. What happened then at the feast? The feast was the same as it is today. It was from Sabbath to Sabbath. Sabbath the first day, and the Sabbath is the last great day. And on the Thursday, during the time of the feast, 80 years ago today, the stock market fell. And then on the Friday, if you remember the ticker tapes they used to use at that time, they couldn't even keep up, and people actually were sleeping on the floors of the financial institutions, trying to just basically keep up with the ticker tape, trying to give some kind of an idea of what had happened the following day. And the following day, the newspapers came out saying, the worst is over, we've gone ahead, we've turned the corner, we're on the way up again, and things are going to be the same as they were before. The following Monday, the crash occurred, and the Tuesday. And stocks were wiped. Basically, as Mr. Armstrong said, he lived through that time. And companies that he was dealing with were literally wiped off the face of the earth. Banks folded. You tried to go and get your money. You feel you've got savings? Fine, go to the bank. But the bank was closed. You couldn't get the money out. So whatever money you reckon you had in the bank is totally worthless. And that was 80 years to this day when the financial world suffered the greatest collapse that we've really known in our lifetime so far. But you know, yesterday the Independent talked about how China, Russia, the Arabs, and France and Japan, I believe, decided that they would start trading oil for gold. They didn't want the dollar there. They didn't want the dollar within the actual trading bloc. Now, they denied it afterwards because of the repercussions from that would be horrendous. But you don't get smoke without fire. And for the Independent to actually get out there and actually quote this means there's something going on. Another very interesting thing happened yesterday. And that was that they began work on a school. The foundations of a school were laid near Jericho. And what was the school for? It was a school for Levites and for priests, of Kohens, to sacrifice. So it's a sacrificial school. The foundations were laid yesterday. Now, these things, you know, we've been watching and waiting and looking for these kind of things for years and years and years. I'm not saying, and let's face it, what actually resulted from the events of 80 years ago eventually resulted in Hitler rising to power. Mr. Armstrong clearly felt that there was going to be a repeat, a financial collapse that would lead to the emergence in Europe of the beast power. And the thing is that it will be different this time. Don't imagine that it's going to have to happen today and it's going to have to happen on Monday. It's going to be different. And let's really understand how different it is today. And that, quite frankly, is that today you cough in America, in Delaware, and over here in London, then somebody else catches a cold within milliseconds. It literally, the communication through the internet, the communication through the trading floors are just nothing. I mean, they don't rely on ticker tape anymore. The ticker tape catch-up would not need to be the same as it was back in 1929 at all. What would happen would the whole thing would just fold up together. It would take milliseconds for this same kind of disaster to occur within the world today. And we say, well, okay, fine, here we are, we're finding ourselves in this position, what can we do? Well, okay, I mean, physically there are things that you can do. First of all, if you know that the banks are going to collapse and therefore you're not going to have any access to money, it makes prudent sense to have something, at least, in your back pocket. In other words, not go along with just purely a credit card and a checkbook. That would be one thing. Another thing, you know, physically we could do is to have something which is real. I mean, I had the Langs come over to our place and they looked at our mountain of coal that we had in the back, which rather than buy half a ton at a go, I bought 3.5 tons this time, because we cook on coal and it heats the house and it heats all the hot water in our particular cottage. So there are certain things you can do and makes prudent sense to do that. In other words, transfer money into real things rather than just rely on the money or the cash. But the main thing is not, I've heard of one particular case of people that started storing grain in their attic. They started storing grain in the attic. Yeah, fine, great. The ceiling caved down. And the entire ceiling disintegrated and came down. You know, that's not the answer. The physical side of things is not the answer. That's not where our strength must lie. We've got to make sure that our strength does lie in the right place, which is a reliance on God. Yes, we are expected to take certain physical precautions, but not the kind of huge precautions that people outside, you know, building a home in the hills with the guns and all the rest of it, which some people are doing. That's not going to save them. That's not going to be where it's at. Contact with God is vital. If we are having a struggle with prayer, then we better get that sorted. We had better get that sorted, because that is the only source of our strength. That's where the strength comes from. And contact with God is absolutely vital. But there's another thing as well, and that's what I want to talk about today. And that is a clear vision of the future. When we are looking at the Feast of Tabernacles, the purpose of the Feast of Tabernacles, or the purpose of the sermons and the sermonettes of the feast, is to give God's people a vision of the future. That's why I've said I wanted all sermons and sermonettes to be on track, focused on the feast, focused on what the feast means, and pointing forward, giving people a vision for the future. Now, that's not always happened, but nevertheless, that's what I wanted. That's what I've asked for. And today, what I would like to talk about is our economic vision. Our economic vision. What are we looking forward to into the future in the economy, in the way money works, in the way our wealth is, you know, what we actually own, how we as physical human beings must exist, and not we will be spirit beings, but how we will be implementing things on this earth in such a way so that the economy can grow and can expand, and yet not expand and grow the way we've expanded and grown here in the Western world and in the world today, but in a very different way. In a different way so that we can have the kind of world that God intends on an economic basis as well, so that people can have wealth, can have prosperity, can have the abundance, which, let's face it, Solomon's reign was a type of the millennium. The millennium isn't a type of Solomon's reign. It's not the other way around. It's Solomon's reign was a type of the millennium. That's only the dull shadow of what the millennium will be. What will, and remember, the thief on the cross, when he finally is resurrected, he will come into paradise. And that paradise is the result of the economy and the growth of the economy in the millennium. So what I would like to talk about, if our economic vision is, I want to talk about the new direction, because that's where all the decisions, the concepts will come from a direction. Secondly, I want to talk about the sabbatical year, because this has an enormous amount to tell us as to what kind of society we will have. And it is such a simple law, but boy, does it shape the society. Does it ever shape the society? The third one is another one that shapes the society, and that's the Jubilee. The Jubilee transforms society. You can't have a corporation in the Jubilee because the land is held and owned by people, not corporations. And corporations, despite the best regulations in the world, are not people. They don't hold the land. Fourthly, I'd rather like to talk about usury and money, because there are rules. There are things within that subject which will actually, again, shape our economy. And finally, I want to talk about our global economic goal. What will be the global economic goal that you, every single one in this room who are baptized members, will need to go ahead and give to the people that you are ruling over? When you're saying, you know, this is the way, walk in it, when they turn right, when they turn left. Okay, what's the basic goal that you've given them? What's that goal, the first Feast of Tabernacles that you actually preside over, when you will get up here to speak? What will you be talking about? Which direction? What's the final goal that they are to aim for? That's what I want to go into as well. So I think we'll probably have the cream tea about 5 o'clock this evening, but no, not really. Okay, the new direction. The direction, as I said, was based on choices. It's based on choices. The two trees is another way of putting those choices. You can talk about the two trees, as Mr. Armstrong did over and over again. You can talk about two spirits. The Spirit of God, which will fill the earth from, you know, sea to sea, as opposed to the spirit of Satan, which is the prince of the power of the air, pumping out into the world today. So these two spirits. The way of give, the way of get. The two gods of this world. One based on get, and one based on give. I say gods of this world. I mean, the god of this age is Satan. But the God is going to step in. And the God is going to make a profound difference. As far as the God of this world, as far as the concepts of this world, there's a book that was very popular back in the 60s. It was written by a man called Shoemaker. It was called Small is Beautiful. And Shoemaker, it was a war. I don't know whether he's still alive, actually. Maybe he's still alive. I don't know. But he's a Buddhist. When he wrote this book, he was a Buddhist. And he therefore has some ideas which may not be strictly accurate by any means, but there are some things that he had to say which were very, very meaningful. And certainly as we look at the world today, and as we look at the position that the world is in today with its quantitative easing, he says, the men that conceived the idea that morality is bunk did so with a mind well stocked with moral ideas, but the mind of the third and fourth generations are no longer well stocked with such ideas. They're well stocked with ideas conceived in the 19th century, namely that morality is bunk. In other words, they're based on a very different kind of concept as the ones that chucked out morality. That everything that appears to be, quote, higher is really nothing but something quite mean and vulgar. I shall give an example already alluded to above, and this was on page 82 of his book, and he's already covered this particular example. He says it's significant because it comes from one of the most influential men of our time, the late Lord Maynard Keynes. Now, he is the one, and Keynesian economics is what is governing our world today. It is what is driving the quantitative easing today. And let me read what he said. He said, for at least another 100 years, and I think that was back in, 1920, 30, something like that. For at least another 100 years, he wrote, we must pretend to ourselves and to everyone. So it's a pretense. It's a bubble. It's a pretense. But we must pretend to ourselves and to everyone that fair is foul and foul is fair. For foul is useful and fair is not. Avarice, usury and precaution must be our gods for a little longer still. For 100 years he was talking about. That's what it was. Avarice, usury, precaution. Usury being interest. Everything has been built on interest. Keynesian economics is interest. That basically, you charge interest on money, and you can then, as Mr. Henderson brought out, you get, say, £1,000 into your bank. You're a banker. You lend out £10,000 based on that, because not everybody's going to come in and ask for their money back. And that the interest that you gain on that money is then put onto your balance sheet as an asset. And therefore, it's all based on smoke and mirrors. When great and brilliant men talk like this, we cannot be surprised if there arises a certain confusion between fair and foul, which leads to double talk, quantitative easing. Double talk, battle gab. Let's call it what it really, really is. I mean, what is quantitative easing? It means to ease the economy by pumping money into it, by quantitative, you know, building up the amount of money supply. It's the last resort. It basically is what happened in Zimbabwe, it's what happened in the Weimar Republic, it's what happened in every single case where the currency collapsed as a result of it. But they've got no other options left. The confusion between fair and foul, which leads to double talk as long as things are quiet, and to crime when they get a bit more lively. Crime? Hitler. Hitler came because of this double talk, because of this kind of nonsense that happened last time round. That avarice, usury and precaution, i.e. economic security, trying to hold it all to ourselves, get, the way of get, should be our gods, was merely a bright idea for Keynes. He surely had nobler gods, but ideas are the most powerful things on earth, and it's hardly an exaggeration to say that by now the gods he recommended have been enthroned. Our entire economic system was based on Keynes. That's why we're at the point of collapse. And the collapse this time round is going to be that much greater. In ethics, as in so many other fields, we have recklessly and willfully abandoned our great classical Christian heritage. This is a Buddhist teacher talking now. We have abandoned our great classical Christian heritage. We have even degraded the very words without which ethical discourse cannot even carry on. What kind of things spring to mind? Virgin. What springs to your mind these days when you say virgin? Is it a virgin or is it an aeroplane? You know, what comes to your mind? Gay. What comes to your mind? Does that mean happy? Or something else? Abominable. But he says words like virtue, love, temperance. He didn't even scratch the surface, as I say. These very words, without which an ethical discourse cannot even carry on. It offenders according to a word, as it says in Scripture. To rebuke within the gate. And you can't even rebuke within the gate. As a result, we are totally ignorant, totally uneducated, in the subject that of all conceivable subjects is the most important. We have no ideas to think with. And therefore are only too ready to believe that ethics is a field where thinking does no good. He goes on, he says, we are suffering from a metaphysical disease, and the cure must therefore be metaphysical. Again, here is his kind of, his Buddhist thinking's come out. Education, which fails to clarify our central convictions, is mere training or indulgence. For it's our central convictions that are in disorder, and as long as the present anti-metaphysical temper persists, the disorder will grow worse. Education, far from ranking as man's greatest resource, will then be an agent for destruction. Does it not ring true to what it says in Romans 1? You know, when the lack of God in your knowledge, in your education, when you get no God there, then everything just like the floodgates open. And that's exactly where we are. That's exactly what's happened today. So that was Keynes. And that is what Schumacher said about him and felt that is the case. We need something which is, we can discuss ideas which have got more lofty aims, more godly aims. Let's put the words as they actually are, godly aims, the way we need to look at life, the way we need to look at everything. Turn over to Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4. Because it's a change in direction. And here in Ephesians 4, Paul is talking about a change in direction. In many cases, he talks about the old man dying and the new man then being created. And being created by God, being created in righteousness, and putting off, as it says, the former conduct of the old man which is corrupt through lusts. And it says in verse 28, it says, let him that stole, so here is a financial area, and remember, the covenant that will be made with Israel and with Judah in the future is not the old covenant. Okay? That is not what we are under. That is not what we will be teaching. It will be a new covenant. Not the way they trashed us in worldwide, but a new covenant. It is the spirit of the law, the intent of the law that has got to be there. And here it says, let him that stole steal no more. But that is not enough. So if we've got Keynesian economics that avarice, usury and precaution have got to be our gods, we've got to get rid of those, yes, but something else has got to be put in its place. And what is it that has got to be put in its place? But rather, let him labour. There is going to be productive labour in the future, in the world tomorrow. And from that productive labour, why? What's the productive labour for? Working with his hands, the thing which is good, that he may have something to give to him that needs. That's the whole society changes. Instead of avarice, usury, precaution, get, in other words, the corruption of words, the corruption of economics, you're now taking the whole thing and you turned it right way up. Because human beings are made in the image of God. They're to become the very sons of God. And you give to such a degree so that they become those sons. That's the purpose. That's the purpose of wealth. That's the purpose of life. And when you see here, somebody who's a thief, it's not just enough to stop stealing. You've got to change the way you act, to change the way you think. Instead of getting, which is stealing, you then start to learn to give. You'd start to learn to give. That's the difference. That's the huge difference that is there. So what is the motivation behind today's trade and commerce, the avarice, the usury, the precaution? What's it for? Well, war is one huge area. Why do they have industry? Why do they have industries that they do? Why is China going to rise to the kind of prominence prophetically? Well, look at the industry. It's got the industry and all the electronics and the steel making and everything else that is in there. That's why it's going to therefore rise to its prominence. It's the economic side that then is channeled into the military side. And that's what we're seeing today. It's vanity itself. It's war. But what about the world tomorrow? When we're looking at the world tomorrow, this change of direction, you're looking at a change of the development of God's mind in humans. That's the stage that we're in today. It's the developing of the mind of God. So instead of, we've got to encourage people, no, you don't go out and steal. No, you don't go out and have usury. And usury doesn't even mean just excessive interest. I know in the English language it means excessive interest. It means any interest. It means any interest at all. Now, we'll go on and we'll discuss that. There is a place for interest. Even in the world tomorrow, there will be a place for interest. For the charging of interest. But not within the Commonwealth of Israel, there's not. Within the Commonwealth of Israel, that's not the way it is. So, the development of God's mind in humans, so that their potential is reached to the degree that they need to, and then environment is there, an economic environment, in which that potential can therefore be reached. And the people, therefore, as God's children, are going to be God-centered. God-centered throughout that entire 1,000 years. Centered on giving to one another, and giving right up to the last great day. Remember, the whole thing, the final point I want to talk about, that global economic goal, is the goal of the last great day. The whole of the millennium is giving to that goal. When all those people come up, there's going to have to be clothes, there's going to have to be food, there's going to have to be farms, there's going to have to be land with buildings, everything else, all there waiting for them, ready, and they get up out of their graves into utopia. That's the economic goal. And so, if we turn over to Ecclesiastes chapter 1, we find in this book that is traditionally read every Feast of Tabernacles by the Jews. And you say, well, I wonder where they actually got that tradition from. Well, I don't know where they got it from, but they did get it, and it was traditionally read during the Feast of Tabernacles. But it says, the words of the preacher, the son of David, Ecclesiastes 1 verse 1, King of Jerusalem, vanity of vanity, vapor of vapors, Habel of Habel, where the word Abel comes from, the word Abel that you find in the Genesis, you know, Cain and Abel. This word is very, very similar. It's Habel as opposed to Abel. It means empty, it means nothing. You know, I've got me a man from the Lord with Cain, But Abel was nothing. And yet he was righteous, and Cain wasn't. But vanity of vanity, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. It's empty, it's nothing, there's nothing there. All the work that we do, everything that we make, what profit has a man in all his labour that he takes under the sun? One generation passes away, another comes, and the earth divides forever. The sun also arises, the sun goes down, hastens place to it where it arose, the wind goes towards the south, turns round to the north, it whirls about continually, and the wind returns to Cain according to its circuits. They understood basic meteorology at that time, in fact probably more than basic meteorology. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea isn't full. To the place from where the rivers come, there they return again. It evaporates, it goes through clouds, it rains on the land, and down it comes. All things are full of labour. Man cannot utter it. The eye isn't satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. In other words, materialism isn't where it's at. Today, what do we have? We have avarice, usury, precaution, all protecting ourselves, all incoming, and the competition is that you all fight and war, and you struggle and strive with each other, and whoever gets to the end of their life with the biggest pile, he wins. Well, brilliant, because we all go into the same place, we all die, we all get buried. And yet, and Solomon saw this, he saw through this. We all strive and struggle, and we go through this economic, trying to amass more and more. For what? For what? You see, that has got to change. When you go into the future, this change in direction. Turn over to chapter 5. Chapter 5, verse 9, it says, moreover, the profit of the earth is for all. The king himself is served by the field. Even if you're a king, you still have to eat. You still have to, you still have your bodily functions. He that loves silver is not going to be satisfied with silver. He that loves abundance with increase. This is all vanity. It's all totally empty. It's worthless. That cannot be the thing that governs the world tomorrow. Pure commercialism will not govern the world tomorrow. That will not, that cannot be. We cannot have pure commercialism. There's more to life than that. In verse 18, behold that which I've seen. It's good and it's fitting for one to eat and to drink and enjoy the good of all his labour that he takes under the sun, all the days of his life that God gives him, for that is his portion. So what's the profit? Is the profit getting the biggest pile at the end of your life? No. What's the profit? It's the work. The physical profit is the labour that you do. The enjoyment in doing. That's the physical enjoyment. And let's face it, we better get that right. Because if we don't enjoy life now, what are you going to do for eternity? What are you going to do in eternity? You're going to be miserable. Don't take any notice of him. Just leave him on his galaxy, Let him be miserable by himself. If we cannot enjoy life now, how are we going to enjoy life for eternity? It is the enjoyment in doing, in actually living, in doing whatever we're doing. It's enjoying the moment. And it doesn't mean to say that you disobey God in the moment. You enjoy the moment for the future. But you still must enjoy it. That's the physical portion that is actually given. Every man also to whom God has given riches and wealth, he's given him power to eat thereof, and to take his portion, and to rejoice in his labour, and this is the gift of God. It's rejoicing in his labour. So, we should try and get something that we do that was enjoyable, that we happen to enjoy doing. And in the future, when you're looking at the actual labour of the people, when you're encouraging people to go into various fields, they will go into fields, and remember what we read in Ephesians? That you don't work to just get. You work so you've got something then with which to give, to contribute to everybody else. And you have a certain part within society as a result of that. So the entire world is going to shift from self-centeredness, where, look at me, aren't I wonderful? The classic example of look at me, aren't I wonderful, is the catwalk. It really does have the ring about it, doesn't it? The catwalk. The latest fashions that come strutting out of behind the veil and out they come. Look at me, aren't I wonderful? You know, that is going to be a thing of the past. Doesn't mean to say the clothes aren't going to be beautiful. Of course they're going to be beautiful. But they're going to be beautiful, not look at me, aren't I wonderful. But, you know, you dress in a way that is pleasing to others, that is, you know, respectful to others. You don't dress like somebody on the catwalk. And there's so many things. You'll go for not just, you know, that is just one small, tiny item. The kind of clothes that we would have. But the quality. What about quality in the world? Quality is going to be something. Look around you. Look at what God has done. Look at what he's made. Look at the quality that is there. Did he have to make the woods, all the woods that he's made? Why did he make the woods that he made? Now, we've got a table at home. It's made of one, well, it's two towers of a trunk that has been joined together. So you've got it's bigger than this, anyway. And it's about this wide. Each part is about that wide, stuck together in the middle. The problem is, the type of wood it is elm. Now, elm has a certain, the reason why we got the elm is because they're chopping all the elms down a few years ago. And we made the table, which is about this thick, great heavy table that we've used for years and years and years. And every so often, we've got to unscrew it underneath and then rejoin it together. Because elm has a habit of buckling, of actually twisting and warping. Why? Because it's exceptionally good in water. Elm is a wood that you can put in water and you can make buckets of. Because it is just good in water. It just works in water. Now, I've got some whiskey in my condo, my cottage. And how was it cured? In oak. Why? Because the tannin in the oak actually gives a flavour to the whiskey. And on you go. Ash. Broom handles. Ash is wonderful for broom handles. Ash burning on the fire is wonderful. That's why it's called ash. Oak will go in there and it will burn, but it'll burn much more slowly. And on you go with all the different types of woods, all made, so that what can man do? He can use the appropriate type of wood and make something beautiful and use quality workmanship to be able to do that. You know, it talks about loving God with all your heart, your soul, your might. The heart is inside. The soul is the fleshly body that we are. The might is what we do. It's from inside to what we are to what we do. And that is how we love God. And that, again, is something that we will need to be teaching in the future. Teaching in the future. It talks about in Proverbs 3, in all the ways, acknowledge him. In all your ways, acknowledge him. And here in Ecclesiastes, let's turn over the page to Ecclesiastes 9. It says in verse 7, go your way, eat your bread with joy, drink your wine with a merry heart, for God now accepts your works. It's what you do, and you enjoy what you're doing. Enjoy the life. Make sure that you enjoy life. Let your garments be always white. Let your head lack no ointment. The feast really teaches us. Remember, this was written by Solomon. Solomon is a type of the millennium. Solomon's reign is a type of the millennium. That's why we're given second tithe. We're given second tithe to make it an abundance. And not only just for abundance for ourselves, so we can give to some other people that perhaps don't have the second tithe or whatever. Live joyfully with the wife who you love all the days of your life of your vanity, which is given you under the sun. All the days of your vanity, for this is your portion in the life. In other words, what you're doing in this life, your portion is living that particular existence. And in your labor that you take under the sun. But the principle is, and the principle we will need to encourage people to apply in the future, is whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. Really put your heart and mind into it. Do it with your might. For there's no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you're going. In other words, enjoy life now. Do it with your might. Do work with your might. And what will that produce? What will that produce within society? Remember, you've given them a goal. The goal is the last great day. The goal is, that's the goal that's going to go through the millennium. And that last great day is 1,000 years from now. So somebody comes to you and says, I think I'm going to make a fridge. Fine. Can you make it the one that actually lasts for 1,000 years? Well, if I did this, I might be able to, okay, well, look and see what you can do. Again, whether in fact you're making fridges in the future, I would imagine that eventually we will be making fridges in the future. Initially, I would very, very strongly imagine that we're not. But eventually, there may be, but it'll be along a different line. And we'll be along a different manufacturing process so that you're able to make something that will last, that will be a quality product. And again, you don't want something that looks like kind of adjectives can we use? Something that doesn't look very nice, let's put it that way. That sits in the corner and you think, I wish I'd never made it like that. You know, you wish, waiting for it to break down, you know, that's basically, you've got to make something which is beautiful to look at. And you can. You can actually build in a cooker, for instance, if it's made properly. We've got an Arga at home, which is why we have the coal outside. But that Arga is solidly constructed. It is a half a ton in weight. It's made of cast iron inside. It costs a fortune to buy new. We did not buy it new. But it cooks very well. It works exceptionally well. It is the kind of creme de la creme of cookers. We had another one that I put in which burned wood better. It lasted about half a day. I think my wife said to me, okay, rip it out, get an Arga, because we had an Arga before. And, the quality product is something that is exceptionally needed at that time in the millennium, because we've got 1,000 years. 1,000 years, and we're looking forward to the last great day. Obsolescence is not the key. And yet, what is the key today? Why is it obsolescence? Because we want to sell the same person that bought the shiny cooker or whatever it was that they bought 5 years ago, and it falls to pieces and the handle comes off and all the rest of the problems that you've got with it, they've got to come back to you and buy another one. Is that really showing love for your neighbour? Well, again, no, it's not. So you're looking at a quality product that are going to be there. Turn over to Isaiah 32. Isaiah 32. We've read this before. We'll read it again, and probably again as well. But we need to understand that when this king, as it says in verse 1, he'll reign in righteousness, and princes shall rule in judgment, making those choices and guiding people and saying, look, this is the way, walk in it. When that is the case, Keynesian economics is going to be a thing of the past. You look down in verse 5, it says, the vile person shall no more be called liberal. Quantitative easing will not be called quantitative easing. It will be called printing money that you don't have, you know, which is basically what it is. It just simply is not, the vile is not going to be called liberal, or the curl said to be bountiful, for the vile person will speak villainy. Virgin will not be an aeroplane. It'll mean what it means. Gay will not mean perverted. It will mean perverted. Oh, no, sorry. Yeah. Even my mind, you know, when you say gay, what do you mean? What do you mean? It's totally twisted, the whole thing. Even in the concept, you know, when I was thinking at that particular time, you know, a few seconds ago, I was thinking about what I was speaking next. And yet my mind could not actually deal with the word gay, because I was not sure what it was actually dealing with. It had been twisted in my own mind as to what the word gay means. Happy. That's what it really means. It doesn't mean perverted at all. And yet it says here, for the vile person will speak villainy. His heart will work iniquity to practice hypocrisy and to utter error against the eternal, to make empty the soul of the hungry. He'll cause the drink of the thirsty to forfail. In other words, you'll label him for what he is. We do not have Keynesian economics in the future. That, you know, avarice, usury, precaution, that is not the way at all. And it will not be the way in the future. And if you turn over to Isaiah chapter 60, and here it says in verse 13, it says, the glory of Lebanon shall come unto you. The fir tree, the pine tree, the box together to beautify the place of my sanctuary. Now notice, the woods are being used here, so the quality is going to be there. Within this change in direction, there's a change from ticky-tacky obsolescence into something which is of quality. Whatever will be made will be of quality. I've got a book at home, I don't know whether I mentioned it, I think I mentioned it before, but I've got a book at home. It's on PHP, which is a language that is used in the internet, when you go on a web, on our website, you use PHP pages. But that particular book has on the front of it, it's got an aqueduct in Spain. The aqueduct is 2,000 years old. It's built without any mortar between the stones, the granite stones. And they've been they were fitted together 2,000 years ago by the Romans, and it goes for about a mile or so long across a valley. And it is still, to this day, carrying water. To this day, it is still carrying water. It can be done. That's 2,000 years Roman technology. It can be done. It can be done. But we live in a society that is totally different. Totally different. I mean, the computers are changing so fast that you don't want them to last very long. You're glad when they actually die the death, because you get the new shiny, bright, shiny model and bring that one in instead that goes that much faster and crashes at twice the speed. But it says here, the glory of Lebanon shall come to you, the fir tree, the pine tree, the box together to beautify the place of my sanctuary, and I'll make the place of my feet glorious. It says in verse 16, you'll also suck the milk of the Gentiles and shall suck the breasts of kings, and you will know that I, the Eternal, are your Savior and your Redeemer, the Mighty One of Jacob. For brass, I'll bring gold. For iron, I'll bring silver. For wood, brass. For stones, iron. It appears as almost as if the tithing of the tithe, the tithe of the tithe, and this is a biblical principle that you'll find that the Levites would tithe to the priests. And it's very likely the tithing of the tithe will actually occur. So people will tithe perhaps in a local country, and then the tithe of the tithe will then go to Jerusalem and make that Jerusalem glorious. Beautiful. Beyond, when you go into Jerusalem in the future, people will be astounded by the beauty, by what has been done. And it says, for brass, gold, I'll bring gold, and for iron, for brass I'll bring gold, for iron I'll bring silver. For wood, brass, for stones, iron, I'll make thy officers peace, and your exactors, your registrars, magistrates, righteousness. So, we're certainly looking at a very different world. The direction is certainly going to change. And one of the greatest changes is going to be the sabbatical year. Now, people think about the sabbatical year, and they think, well, you just basically don't do anything. You just leave your land and let it grow and do whatever it wants to. You just forget about it. And I remember even talking, this misconception is something that's even been in the church. I remember talking to a minister who was over one of the African land programs. And he says, oh, I'm just about to have a sabbatical year. And I said, really? I'm very interested in how are you going to do that? He looked at me as if I was a total raving lunatic and said, well, we're not going to do anything. It's a sabbatical year. You just basically do nothing. I said, you don't know anything about sabbatical years, because that's not the way as far as the sabbatical year is concerned. Yes, I mean, the raw basis is like the Sabbath. I'm going to keep the Sabbath. Oh, well, fine. What are you going to do? I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to sit there for the entire day, which some people do. I mean, some people, when they first come in the church, they keep the Sabbath by going into their room, sitting on a chair or a bed, and sitting there. That's it. They're resting. And you go into Jewish hotels, and you're not allowed to press a button. Where is work? What is work? Is work pressing a button? Can you flick a switch? What is going on behind it? They've got special coffee makers. That they haven't got a button, they've got something else. It's a lever. Yeah, I think you can pull a lever, but you're not allowed to press a button, because pressing a button means doing work because it's got electronics behind it. But you can pull a lever because that's somehow not, I don't quite know why, but it's not doing work. And it goes into this ridiculous nonsense. But again, we're administering the spirit of the law. And just as in the Sabbath, what are we doing in the Sabbath? We're making the Sabbath a delight. We're making sure that others are refreshed. So if you're driving down the road, which you can do driving down the road, and you find somebody that is broken down at the side of the road, or somebody, let's say the classic one, your neighbor's house goes on fire, you get out there, you help. Why? So that he is refreshed. So that he is refreshed. It's a convocation. That means you gather together. You come together and you keep the Sabbath by coming together into a convocation. Or if you can't convene, whatever it is, you get on the internet and you do so that way. It's a holy day, and you think God's thoughts. Now there's a real one. There is a real one. And so the same thing, when you're coming to the sabbatical year, it is something that the church in the past, and people when they first came into the church, when the church first started using the sabbatical year, they made some horrendous problems. They made some really horrendous difficulties for the farmers. There were farmers that, quite frankly, went bankrupt because of the administration of the letter of part of the sabbatical year. And this is the problem. Grain farmers became bad examples by just doing nothing and leaving their farms just go to rack and ruin over the sabbatical year. That is not the case. Turn over to Deuteronomy 14. Deuteronomy 14. Because yes, sabbatical year, you do not go ahead and work your land. Yes, you allow it to rest. And there's no question of that. And even God says and talks about the fact that when Israel was out of the land, then the land could enjoy their Sabbaths. In other words, it would go back to rack and ruin. It would go back to trees. You'd have trees growing eventually at the end of it. And so, there is that aspect to it. But here in Deuteronomy 14, verse 28, it says, at the end of 3 years, you'll bring forth all the tithe of your increase the same year, and you'll lay it up within your gates, and the Levite, because he's not no part or inheritance, the fatherless, the widow, shall come and eat this, satisfied, and the eternal your God may bless you in the work that you do. So here you see economically, this is the third tithe year. So it goes every 3 years, and the next 3 years, sixth year, and then you come to the sabbatical year. Because it says, at the end of every 7 years, then you will make a release. So it is not just the case of getting the land and leaving it go to rack and ruin. It is a case that there is also a release. And this is the type of release. Now, this is the problem. This is the problem. And what actually happened, Mr. Armstrong saw this aspect of the sabbatical year, and he saw the fact that there is a release there, and he realized not only do we not know when the sabbatical year falls, because remember, it's 777, and it comes up to the Jubilee, and the Jubilee then is tacked on, and then you start again, you go 777, and so on. Not only do we not know when the sabbatical year actually is, but if you have got a mortgage on your farm from the bank, the bank does not say, oh, it's the sabbatical year, oh, therefore we'll go ahead and we'll relax, and we're not going to charge you any interest on this particular loan that you have from us. That doesn't work. If the bank was able to do that, in fact, no, it's not even charging you any interest on the sabbatical year. As it says here, it says, and this is the manner of the release. Every creditor that lends anything to his neighbor shall release it and not exact it of his neighbor or his brother, because it is the eternal's release. That is, the capital sum is wiped clean. Can you imagine what happens there? I mean, this is the thing that happened, as Mr. Armstrong saw, that no, the spirit of the law, if you're applying the sabbatical year, it's not enough to say, oh, you just don't do anything on your land. You've got to have this area as well in place. Therefore, to insist that the farmer then goes 6 years and then does nothing on the seventh is just simply, you're keeping half a law. You're attempting to keep half a law. That doesn't fit. This is why he made the rule that the farmers can go ahead and rest a seventh of the land and rest it in rotation and do it that way. Because in that way they can survive. In that way they don't go bankrupt. Because this area here also is in place, this year of release. And it is that of a foreigner, verse 3, notice, and I notice what it says here, of a foreigner you may exact it again. But that which is your brother, your hand shall release. So there's a distinction between those within Israel and the Commonwealth of Israel and those outside of Israel. Now this, again, when we go into the subject of usury, you'll find that also applies. And those within the Commonwealth of Israel, you're not allowed to charge usury. You're not allowed to go, in fact, even the actual capital portion, every 7 years, you've got to wipe it clean. What bank is going to... You just imagine this law, this one law being put into effect now, and you go and you get a loan from the bank, and somebody else goes and gets a loan from the bank. And come the sabbatical year, the loan's wiped clean. Can a bank survive? It's ridiculous. It's impossible. So banking, as we know it, isn't going to be there. There is not going to be banking the way it is today. It just, how can it possibly exist? How can banking possibly exist with this one simple law? Just one simple law that every 7 years you get rid of the capital sum. And that should apply within the church. Now, it is. I mean, if we have loans within the church, that is how that still applies. 7 years is the maximum. Or 6 years, and then the seventh year is wiped off. Why? What's God doing this for? Well, verse 4. To the end that there will be no poor among you. Remember, the reign of Solomon is a type of the millennium. It's not the other way around. So when we come to the millennium, this kind of thinking, this kind of mentality will be there in the financial area. To the end that there is no poor among you, for the Eternal shall greatly bless you in the land, which the Eternal your God gives you for an inheritance to possess. And verse 7. If there is any among you a poor man of one of your brethren within any of your gates, in the land which the Eternal gives you, your God gives you, you will not harden your heart nor shut your hand from your poor brother. In other words, it does not mean that you're precluded from actually making loans. You still lend. It says, but you shall open your hand wide to him, and you will surely lend him sufficient for his need in that which he wants. So the need is, if there's a need there, and you determine there is genuinely a need, it says, you beware that there's not a thought in your wicked heart, saying, the seventh year, the year of release, is at hand, and your hand I be evil against your poor brother, and you give him nothing. Now, I want you to notice that he needs. Now, many times, if people basically sit on their backside and do nothing, and will basically sponge off everybody else, that's not need. That's greed. That is greed. That is selfishness on their part, and it is not good for them to go ahead and give. But if you see a genuine need, it says, beware that your eye is not evil against your poor brother, that you don't give him anything, and he cries to the Eternal against you, and it's then sin to you. You will surely give him, and your heart shall not be grieved when you give it to him. In other words, it's not a case of, you know, like Scrooge with your pack of money, and you kind of give him as little as possible. You shall not be grieved when you give it to him, because for this thing the Eternal your God will bless you in all your works, in all you put your hand to do. This is a living law. It's a living law just as much as tithing is. It's a living law of God, and we do need to make sure we don't cross this boundary, just as we don't cross the tithing boundary. For the poor shall never cease out of the land. You're always going to have people that make dumb decisions and find themselves in a problem. And, you know, we all do. All of us. Well, maybe not all of us. Maybe some of us are more wise than most of the rest of us. Let's put it that way. For the poor shall never cease out of the land. Therefore I command you, saying, you shall open your hand wide to your brother, to the poor and to the needy that are in your land. So, this simple law, and notice, it is done as far as a personal, you know, individuals are concerned. Individuals are what is being talked about there. There's no kind of limited company that is being mentioned here. I mean, when you look at the limited companies that you have today, I mean, why limited companies? What's the purpose of a limited company? A limited company is there so if it gets into trouble, it can die. Because it's an individual in legal terms. It's an individual. A limited company is an individual. That if you get into trouble and you can't pay your debts, you can step to one side and it can die. And then all the people it owes money to, tough luck. You're on your own. You're on your bike. You shouldn't have dealt with a limited company after all. But if that limited company becomes powerful, that limited company doesn't die. It becomes a public limited company. And a bigger and bigger and bigger public limited company, and it swallows up all the other public limited companies, and you can never get rid of the wretched thing. And yet, human beings die. Human beings die. And these laws here are about interactions between human beings. Limited companies have no place whatsoever within the work of God in the millennium. Turn over to Genesis chapter 12, in this area, Genesis 12. Because we're talking about individuals, and we're talking specifically about families. Both ends of my Bible are falling apart, I tell you. Genesis 12, it says in verse 7, the Eternal appeared to Abram and said, unto your seed, not unto your seed and their limited companies, but unto your seed, and just there, your seed, I will give this land. And there he built an altar to the Eternal that appeared to him. As we go into the Jubilee, it's very much a case that the Jubilee and the sabbatical year go hand in glove. And the implications of the sabbatical year. If you turn over to Exodus 23, you find in Exodus 23, notice in verse 9, it says, also you do not oppress a stranger, for you know the heart of the stranger. Now notice the context of this. You will not oppress a stranger, for you know the heart of a stranger, seeing that you are strangers in the land of Egypt. And 6 years you shall sow your land, and you shall gather the fruits of the year of. But the seventh year you will let it rest and lie still, that the poor, the poor of your people may eat. And it's just been talking about the stranger and the heart of the stranger and how you know about the heart of a stranger. That the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave the beasts of the field shall eat. And in like manner shall you deal with your vineyard and also with your olive yard. So we're looking at this economic change. It's going to rest and lie still. It'll be unplowed, yes. You don't plow in the sabbatical year. You see, because of the release that we've just been seeing, there's not going to be banking as it is today. Banking is going to change. It's going to be a total change as far as banking is concerned. Not only if it's going to be unplowed, and yet you're also going to go ahead and gather the fruits in the 6th year, but the 7th year you let it rest, and it will then be for the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave the beasts of the field may eat. And so other people are able to gain from it. In fact, turn over to Leviticus 25. Leviticus 25, this is the other scripture that we need to put together with this one. And we can then start to see the change that is here. Because here in Leviticus 25, it talks about in verse 23, it says, the land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine, and you are strangers and sojourners with me. In other words, the land is actually being managed and being kept and being used by whoever happens to be on it at the particular time. But the economic change that we see, that it's resting and it's lying still, we can see that if you're going to go ahead and have, let's just read it in verse 8, and you shall number the seventh, I've got the wrong one. Verse 3, it says, 6 years shall you sow your field, and 6 years you'll prune your vineyard and gather the fruit thereof. But the 7th year will be a Sabbath of rest to the land, a Sabbath for the Eternal. You shall neither sow the field nor prune your vineyard. That which grows of its own accord of your harvest, you shall not reap. But it does allow you, as it goes on, it says, neither gather the grapes of your vine undressed. In other words, you don't take the vines that are producing grapes and then gather them and make wine out of them. For it is a year of rest to the land, and the Sabbath of the land shall be food for you. So it's not that you don't eat of it, it's that you don't harvest it. There's a difference. You can go in there, you can pick whatever you need for your own use, and you can bring it in, you can use it there and then. But you don't go ahead and start harvesting it. It'll be food for you, and for your servant, and for your maid, and for your hired servant, and for the stranger that sojourns with you, and for your cattle, and for the beasts that are in the land, and all the increase thereof be for food. So it is going to be there for food, but you don't harvest it. You don't take it. You don't make silage of it. You have a silage, presumably. You need to keep your silage over the year. And then you therefore use your animals and bring your animals down. But it starts to actually point in a certain direction as far as agriculture is concerned. And if you know that you're leaving your land unplowed, and perhaps you've got a vegetable garden. How are you going to cope with that for the following year? Are you just going to let it go rank, you know, to weeds? Or is it more a case that you mulch it? You put mulch on the top, and you keep the weeds somewhat suppressed, and you also bring animals in, and they will graze the weeds down, which is what it's talking about there. Now, what do those two things tell you? Well, it talks about the soil erosion is therefore less, because you're actually going to have the land growing weeds that are then grazed by animals. It also means that every single farmer's got to have animals. You can't have the great agribusiness that you've got today. It is impossible to have agribusiness. So you're now seeing an economic change within the society. The fertility is going to increase. It's going to be a natural fertility that comes in there. The water pollution is going to be decreased because you're going to have mulching and also the green manuring of the land. All of these are going to contribute to a change and a transformation within the society. It's going to change the economics of the society. I mean, greengrocers are going to be a thing of the past. How can you be a greengrocer? Oh, you're a greengrocer for 6 years. On the seventh year, sorry, I've got nothing. You know, I've closed my doors. I'm going to go, I've got my boat, and I've got to, maybe greengrocers are the ones who also have a boat and they go sailing off somewhere. That's about all you can do. So what is going to have to happen for this? You're not going to have the corporations because they can't own the land. You've got to be able to own some land. And you can't guarantee that you're making, you know, as I said last year in Kentucky, you know, the one king that's not going to be around is Burger King. And basically, Burger King will not be there. You can't have a Burger King. It just doesn't fit. It cannot fit within these laws. It just simply cannot be there at all. But you see, you're going to have animals on there. Your cattle and the beasts are going to be able to graze the land, be able to come into your cornfields and come into, presumably, even your vegetable garden. I mean, yeah, if you've got goats, you've probably got them in there anyway. but it's just, you know, they're actually going to have to open the fences and allow the animals in there to graze and allow them to graze down. But it's something which is controlled. This is what I said to this minister. He says, what are you going to do for the sabbatical year? Oh, we're not going to do anything. Well, it's like keeping the Sabbath. What are you going to do the Sabbath? Oh, we're going to rest, do nothing. Well, that's not the way it is. There's more to it than that. You've got animals here. You therefore have got to have animals. Now, if they've got an agricultural program that have got no animals on there, how are you going to keep a sabbatical year that's going to keep the land in trim, that's going to go ahead and eat the land down, to keep it ready and prepared for the when you do actually have to go in there and you know, you don't want to go in there with your machete to try and to clear the land every single on the eighth year, on the first year each time. It just doesn't work like that. You've got to try and bring your livestock in, and the ruminants coming in there then inoculate the soil with bacteria, and you're having a total different society, you're having a total different economic system. The only way that you're going to have vegetables, for instance, is if you have self-sufficiency in a vegetable garden. You don't have to necessarily do it yourself, but you've got to have some kind of arrangement with somebody that does. Therefore, what does that tell you? Well, it's the land of unwalled villages it talks about in Ezekiel. It's talking about villages. It's talking about a village culture that is there, that people will live in villages. It talks about not laying land, you know, house to house and field to field, leaving a way in the earth. Therefore, you're going to have small homesteads. And the homesteads are going to have to produce their own vegetables to some degree, or have an arrangement with somebody to come in and produce the vegetables, because every seventh year you're going to be eating nothing but meat and eggs. You'll get very bound if you eat nothing but meat and eggs. But you know, you've got to do something. You've got to have some greenery from somewhere. What are you going to do? Go out and collect, you know, every 7 years I'm going to live on nettles. You know, nettles are edible. But I mean, are you going to live on nettle soup? You live on that every seventh year? And it's going to be a land of abundance. It's not going to be like that. You're going to have either your own land or an arrangement with somebody. And it's going to have to be small units that are there, self-sufficiency. And as it says over in Ezekiel 38, it talks about the unwalled villages. There's another thing that it does. If you know that crop is going to have to then produce for you by self-seeding, by self, you know, production, What is that going to do to the varieties that are grown? Today, the EU says, it has now actually revoked its law that says that cucumbers have got to be such and such, so much of a bend. If it's not so much, anything more than so much of a bend, it wasn't allowed to be sold. It had to be straight. And cabbages had to be, oh, I don't know what the cabbages had to be. They had all kinds of stupid laws, a big great book that thick. And the varieties were chopped right down to just a few varieties of apples, just a few varieties of each of the produce. But if you've got sabbatical year there, what about varieties? How are you going to survive? You've got to have varieties that come into season in different times of the year. So if you want a cabbage, you're not going to just grow one kind of cabbage. You're going to grow a series of cabbages because come sabbatical year, and you're going to let them seed, because they're a biennial cabbage, and you let it seed, and then you go out and you'll find a cabbage that you could use for lunch that day. Because you've seeded in the right way. So it governs the kind of seeding that you've got, the varieties, the greater number of varieties that are there. The planting, the way you plant, the how you allow things to self-seed even. You will allow certain things to self-seed. I had spinach beet, 2 years ago, that last year seeded. I'd left it. And in that area, I didn't grow any this year, but in that area I've got several spinach beet. They're actually growing in the rows of parsnips at the moment. So I've let them, where they've grown, in rows of, aren't they, Charlie? He's actually been there, seen them. And the spinach beet's growing there because it's self-seeded. Now you're going to have to organise that in some way. And I mean, can you imagine a big industry organising itself in this way? Can you imagine that? A McDonald's being able to have to grow the varieties and let itself seed and so on. It's impossible. You can't have a society like it is today. Fair is foul and foul is fair. Yeah, that's fine until you get sabbatical year. And then, you know, you are completely and totally stymied. It is not the way it's going to be. You can't have it that way. Meat and eggs are going to increase at that time. You know, there's going to be a glut of meat and eggs. Why? Because you presumably your silage or hay or whatever you're making at that time, if unless the grass grows all the way through the year, which it may, you might not even have to make hay or silage. But if you are making hay or silage, therefore you're going to cut down the number of animals, so that there's going to be an abundance of meat, there's going to be abundance of eggs. You're not going to cut down the animals altogether. But these are all feeding into the economics of the society. And you're looking at an economic basis there, which is totally different from anything that we have today. Fruit trees are going to be incredibly important. Incredibly important. Because, again, what will you do with fruit trees? Are you going to go ahead and have just one variety of fruit tree? You're going to have several different varieties of fruit trees. Remember, it talks about not laying house to house and field to field, but there's no way in the earth. So you're going to have shelter belts. You're going to have a production of wood within the shelter belts. All of these are going to feed into the economy. It is the economy is going to be a village-based economy, certainly initially. And as we go on, let's have a look at the Jubilee. Turn over to Ezekiel 36. Ezekiel 36. And the way I'm going, I'm not going to get all my points done. That is an advantage of not having points. Nobody knows that you don't get them all done. But Ezekiel 36, it says in verse 10, "And I will multiply men upon you, all the house of Israel, even all of it, and the city shall be inhabited, and the waste places will be builded." And down in verse 24, it says, "I will take you from among the heathen and gather you out of all the countries, and I'll bring you to your own land. And there I'll sprinkle clean water upon you, and you'll be clean from all your filth and all your idols, and I'll cleanse you. A new heart I will give you, and a new spirit I'll put within you. I'll take away the stony heart from out of your flesh, and I'll give you a heart of flesh, and I'll put my spirit within you, and cause you to walk in my statutes, and you shall keep them." And if you go over to verse 33, it says, "In the eternal God, in that day I will cleanse you from all your iniquities. I will also cause you to dwell in the land, and the waste shall be builded, dwell in the cities, and the waste shall be builded. And the desolate land will be tilled, whereas it lay desolate in the sight of all that passed by. And they shall say, this land that was desolate has become like the Garden of Eden. So it's going to be, again, it's going to be cared for. By the Garden of Eden, the waste and the desolate and the ruined cities have become clipped, as it better translated, and are inhabited. And it says in, it goes on, it says, then the heathen, the nations are asked round about, you shall know that I am the Eternal, that build the ruined places, plant that which is desolate. The Eternal has spoken, and I will do it. Thus says the Lord Eternal, I will yet for this be inquired by the house of Israel, but I'll increase upon them men like a flock, as the holy flock, as the flock of Jerusalem, in her solemn feasts. So it'll be the feast days, there'll be gathering centres in the cities, and it goes, flows straight into the Valley of Dry Bones. And in that Valley of Dry Bones, in Ezekiel 38, verse 11, we find here, and you'll say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. That's the type of society that will be there. Unwalled villages, I'll go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls, having neither bars nor gates. You know, the locksmith will be a thing of the past. You'll get in a car, you'll press a button, if you get in a car at all. You get in a horse and buggy and you press a button. It talks, again, putting in your notes, Isaiah 5, verse 8, not building house to house or field to field. But we go back to Leviticus 23. Leviticus 23. And this land of unwalled villages that have been talking about, with the Spirit of God, with the fenced and clipped cities, which are the gathering centres, what we're looking at here is Leviticus 25, sorry, Leviticus 25 and verse 8. It says, and you will number 7 Sabbaths of years. It's tied into the sabbatical year. 7 times 7 years, and the space of 7 Sabbaths of years shall be 49 years. So the maths is very clear. And then you will cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month. In the Day of Atonement shall you make the trumpet sound throughout all your land, and you'll hallow the 50th year, and proclaim liberty throughout all the land, and to all the inhabitants thereof. And it shall be a jubilee to you, and you will return, every man to his possession, and you'll return, every man to his family. So the land, as it says in verse 23, the land shall not be sold forever. The land is mine, and you are strangers and sojourners with me. Now again, corporations have no claim on the land at all, none whatsoever. Now, maybe in the cities, we'll go on and read, you can go ahead and buy things within the cities. But the kind of corporations that we've got today, they just can't exist. The abundance of the supply of food because of the sabbatical year will therefore stop the kind of food corporations existing. But a jubilee shall that 50th year be to you. You will not sow nor reap that which grows of itself, nor gather the grapes of it in your vine and dressed. For it's the jubilee, it will be holy to you. You'll eat the increase thereof out of your field. So on that land, on that particular time, there are 2 years that you've got to survive. I mean, how are you going to do that? Well, there's a very good chance that Joseph will be in charge of the economic side of things. And remember, Joseph stored up the grain. And there'll be presumably stores being put up around the entire, all the nations will have these huge stores. Because the Jubilee comes along, you've got 2 years you've got a store. What will they then be used for? Well, the last great day. When the people come up in the last great day, the stores will be there. The stores will be there to be used. There'll be buildings that have been used presumably through the millennium. Totally different from anything that we've got today. The economics are totally different. Your fair is foul and foul is fair. Keynes hasn't a clue. Not a single solitary clue. And in the year of this Jubilee, you'll return every man to his possession. And if you sell anything of your neighbor or buy anything from your neighbor's hand, you will not oppress one another according to the number of the years. After the Jubilee, you'll buy of your neighbor according to the number of the years of the fruit he will sell to you. So you can't buy land. You can rent land. That's basically that is the rule. The land is owned by the family. And it says, the land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine. You are strangers and sojourners with me. Therefore, you can only rent it. You rent it for the maximum, would be not even 50 years. You'd rent it for 49 years, 48 years. Because 49 years, but that 49th year will be a sabbatical year anyway. Now, when you come into verse 23, land shall not be sold, it says, and all the land of your possession you will grant a redemption for the land. If your brother becomes poor and has sold some of his possession, this is verse 25 now, and any of his kin come to redeem it, then shall he redeem that which his brother sold. And if the man has none to redeem it, then he himself is able to redeem it, then let him count the years of the sale thereof, and restore the overplus to the man to whom he sold it, that he may return to his possession. So even if you rent land, if you go ahead and give somebody some money, he has got a right to come back to you, you know, after, say, 5 years, 10 years, say, look, here's the money back again for the remainder. Maybe you've got another 10 years to go. Here's the remainder that is there. I want my land back. So the land is in the families and the control of the families. The families are controlling the land, and the Jubilee causes that to be the case. The responsibility is that it makes the all land family managed. Family managed. All land. All land, apart from within the cities. And it says, but if he's not able to restore it, then it'll remain in the hand of him that bought it until the year of the Jubilee, and then it'll go out and return to his possession, free of charge. And if a man sell a dwelling house in a walled city, then he may redeem it within a whole year after it's sold. A full year may he redeem it. Now, will it be walled cities? Well, there are going to be these clipped cities. They're going to be centres of for the feasts and for things like that. But it's going to be a land of unwalled villages. That's what it's described as far as the land of Israel is concerned. And if it's not redeemed within the space of a full year, then the house can then go into his generations. But the whole thing is owned by God. There's no land speculation. You can't have land speculation, because the price of the land is set. And incidentally, just put in your notes, because we've got another points to cover, Ezekiel 45 verse 1, the land is divided by lot, and that's how the land is divided. He's talking about the future. In Ezekiel 46 verse 16 to 18, this principle of the Jubilee, not principle of the Jubilee, the law of the Jubilee, will be applied within the world tomorrow. Very, very clear that it's going to be applied to the world tomorrow. And even the rulers, and the indication is that even if we are rulers, we cannot go ahead and give an inheritance to our children except from our land. We can't go and take it from somebody else. You know, Naboth's vineyard was all about, remember Ahab and Naboth's vineyard? That was all about the inheritance. Inheritance, and he didn't want to sell this vineyard, and he was right next to the palace. And he manipulated himself to try and gain what wasn't his at all. Now, if we go over to Isaiah 59, it says in verse 20, and the Redeemer shall come to Zion, and to those that turn from transgressions in Jacob, says the Eternal. And as for me, this is my covenant with them, says the Eternal. My spirit that is upon you, my word which I put in your mouth, shall not depart out of your mouth, nor the mouth of your seed, nor the mouth of your seed's seed, says the Eternal, from this time forever. Arise, shine, for your light is come. Now remember, this is Zion, and it's the seed that he's talking about, the little ones, that then goes into the future, then go into the millennium. And then he says, arise, shine, for your light is come. The glory of the Eternal is risen upon you. And behold, the darkness will cover the earth, gross darkness the people. You know, fair is foul, foul is fair, for fair is you. Foul is useful and fair is not. Gross darkness covers the people. But the Eternal shall arise upon you, and his glory shall be seen upon you, and the Gentiles shall come to your light, and kings will come to the brightness of your rising. And it says, if you turn over a page to chapter 62, verse 1, it says, for Zion's sake I will not hold my peace. For Jerusalem's sake I will not rest until the righteousness thereof goes forth as brightness, and salvation thereof is a lamp that burns. And the Gentiles will see your righteousness, and all the kings your glory. And you shall be called by a new name which the mouth of the Eternal shall name. And this part of this, if you turn over to Ezekiel chapter 45, Ezekiel 45, you find here in verse 9, it says, "Thus says the Lord Eternal, let it suffice you, princes of Israel, remove violence and spoil and execute judgment and justice. Take away your exactions from my people, says the Lord Eternal. You shall have just balances, a just ephah, a just bath. An ephah and the bath shall be one measure, that the bath may contain the tenth part of an omer. The ephah and the tenth part of an omer, the measure shall therefore be after the omer. And the shekel shall be 20 gerahs," you know, the 20 pence, of, the 20 shillings in a pound. We're not going to have, it doesn't appear that we're going to have decimalization. It doesn't appear like you're going to have the decimalization. So we're all, it's going to go back. The calculators that we've got today will need to be realigned in some ways if we're going to have them at all. 20 shekels and 5 and 20 shekels, 15 shekels shall be your mina. I mean, you're completely, I mean, this kind of finances is something that is, it just doesn't, even though I can remember, you know, 12 pence to a shilling, 20 shillings to a pound, and we used to have, what do you call it, what's 21 pounds?
Guinea.
Guinea, 21 shillings, a guinea. You see, again, your mind goes blank. but you don't work in them anymore. You know, you don't work in guineas. Not that I know of, anyway. And this and the shekel should be 20 gerahs, 20 shekels, 25 shekels, 15 shekels should be your mina. And so the defining and measuring is now metric. But if you turn back to Leviticus 19, I'm sorry I'm having to rush through this a little bit and hack bits out as I go. I should know by now. But in verse 33, it says, "And if a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you will not vex him. But the stranger that dwells with you shall be unto you as one born among you, and you will love him as yourself, for you are strangers in the land of Egypt." And it says, and the one way you'll do this, you will do no unrighteousness in judgment, in meter yard, in weight, in measure. Just balances, just weights, just ephah, a just hin you shall have. I am the Eternal your God that brought you out of Egypt. So quantitative easing doesn't fit. How can you have quantitative easing? You print more paper money, which is worthless, and you put it into the system? Absolutely, totally, utterly impossible. And what is it that's going to actually do that? What will give us the actual the standard? Leviticus 27, right at the end of Leviticus, just before Numbers. And it says in verse 16, and here is, as far as I can tell, the standard that will be applied. It certainly is a standard that's applied here. "And if a man shall sanctify to the Eternal some part of a field of his possession, the estimation shall be according to the seed thereof. An omer of barley seed shall be valued as, notice, it's sanctified unto some part of a field." So you're looking at the field, you're looking at the land, your actual area of land is according to the productive capacity of that land. And it ties the money to the land that produces a certain amount. "An omer of barley seed shall be valued at 50 shekels of silver. And if he sanctifies fields from the year of the Jubilee, according to the estimation, it will stand." So you've got 50 shekels, for one for each year, all the way through to the end. "But if he sanctifies field after the Jubilee, then the priest shall reckon unto him the money according to the years that remain, even unto the year of the Jubilee, and it shall be abated from the estimation." So in other words, it's however, each shekel is 1 year, and it is an omer of barley seed that is produced off that land. So if the land is very productive, you get more for it. If it's not as productive, if it's a steep slope somewhere, you get less for it. But it gives you this measure. And verse 25, "And all your estimation shall be according to the shekel of the sanctuary. 20 gerahs shall be the shekel." So the currency, therefore, is stability. The way in which things will work, you know, avarice, usury, and precaution have no place. Pumping up money by quantitative easing, worthless money based on greed, based on interest. In fact, let's just have a look at this. Turn over to Leviticus 25, verse 35. "And if your brother becomes poor," Leviticus 25:35, "and falls in decay with you, then you will relieve him. Yes, though he's a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with you. So it doesn't matter, even strangers, once they come under the authority of the Commonwealth of Israel, they'll then come under the advantages. You take no usury from him or increase. And remember, the sabbatical year, within the capital sum was to be wiped out as well. The capital sum was to be removed in the sabbatical year. And during those other years, you were not allowed to charge interest to your brother. But fear your God, that your brother may live with you. It's giving to the individual, so that he may live with you, so that he may have a decent life. So to this end, that there is no poor among you in the land. And it says, you shall not give your money upon usury, or lend in victuals for him. For I am the Eternal your God that brought you forth out of the land of Egypt, to give you the land of Canaan, and be your God. And if you turn over to Deuteronomy 23, say, my apologies for roaring through this, but Deuteronomy 23, we're looking here in verse 19. It says, you shall not lend upon usury to your brother. Usury of money, usury of victuals, usury of anything that is lent upon usury. That means no interest is charged whatsoever. Your capital is wiped out every 7 years. Interest is forbidden. But to a stranger you may lend upon usury, but to your brother you shall not lend upon usury. Now remember what we said, the sabbatical year, if he was a stranger, you don't wipe out the capital sum. But if it's you've got Israel in the center, you've got nations around about Israel looking in, and they see the prosperity of Israel. Interest can be charged to the nations round about. The sabbatical year does not apply to them, but within Israel they'll see the difference. So what were they going to want to do? Well, I want to become part of this thing called Israel, this Commonwealth of Israel. And that, in that way, the world tomorrow, the actual kingdom of God rulership, will spread right out, and it'll be a forced case. The nations all around will be forced to come in and actually see what's going on in Israel and carry the report back again. And this is the basis of the economy. The entire economy will work, and so that in the Commonwealth of Israel, there'll be this two-tier system. The Gentiles will be charged it until they become part of the Commonwealth of Israel. And then, once they become part of it, they can't, because we've just read about the stranger not being charged usury, and the stranger that will be living with you will be as one born in the land. There's no difference between, you know, Jew, Greek, whatever. It's the new covenant rule that is going to be there. Okay, so usury and the Commonwealth of Israel in that regard. Put in your notes, when we're looking at the preparation for the last great day, put in your notes Luke 23:43. This, I tell you this today, you will be with me in paradise. So they're looking forward to a time where it will be absolute and total paradise. And if we turn over to Isaiah 55, we see words such as that, such as the words in Luke 23 that Christ said while he was actually hanging there, looking forward to this time that we're talking about. It's a vision of the economic system. That's what we need to keep in mind. And these words, as it says here in Isaiah 55, it says, my thoughts are not your thoughts in verse 8, neither are my ways your ways, says the Eternal. For as the heaven is higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than yours, and my thoughts than your thoughts. And the thinking that Christ had on the cross, waiting for death, was still towards the people who were with him. And he actually expressed that. He said, look, you will be there. It will be paradise. And having said that, and the words actually coming out of his mouth, he says, look, as the rain comes down, the snow from heaven, and returns not there, but it waters the earth, and it makes it bring forth and bud, that it may give seed to the sower and bread to the eater. It's like rain that comes onto the earth, and it actually causes the earth to blossom and to become whatever it's actually becoming. The word of God comes out of God's mouth. And Christ was God in the flesh. He is God now. He's God in a resurrected form today. The word that came out of his mouth on that cross, that actually said, look, you will be with me in paradise, means what it says. It will, that word will be carried out. It will be caused to carry out. So shall my word be that goes forth out of my mouth. It shall not return to me void, but it will accomplish that which I please, and it will prosper in the thing wherein thou sent it. So we can see very clearly here that that word will eventually have effect. It'll be having effect right through the millennium, through the 1,000 years. The quality will be there. The total, you know, fair is foul, foul is fair, the Keynesian economics will be completely pushed into the past. The sabbatical year, the jubilee year, simple laws such as that, laws about usury, about the Commonwealth of Israel, about the nations looking in from outside. This will cause the world tomorrow to actually spread and to push itself, not to push itself out. It will be gladly embraced by the people on the outside as they see this actually occurring. And this is the view, this is the vision that we have, and this is the vision that we've got to keep in mind. Because quite frankly, today is that, as I mentioned, this anniversary of what took place 80 years ago. 240s is important, it's significant. Is it going to be happen again today? Don't know. What about on Monday and Tuesday? Don't know. I'm not sure. It is significant though. And we do know this, that the direction in which the world has gone, this fair is foul, foul is fair, because foul is useful and fair is not. Avarice, usury and precaution, and the way in which the quantitative easing is working and all the other machinations that we find within society, they're all going to be swept to someone's side. Simple, easy, straightforward laws. Sabbatical year, jubilee, usury, money values. Simple things like that put into place will produce a totally, totally transformed economic world.
Thank you, Mr. Bowles. If you'd like to take up your hymn books and please turn to page number 102. The last hymn today, we'll sing His Mercy Never Fails, after which, if Andrew Munro would close the service with prayer. Page number 102. All right.